This is the Mobile Tech Podcast, brought to you by worldpodcasts.com. Now here's your host, Tech Girl Miriam Joie.
Brought to you by MediaTek. Hi, and welcome to the Mobile Tech Podcast. I'm your host, Miriam Joie, and today is Wednesday, June 8th, 2022, and I have the excellent Finn Barmonian of MediaTek here to talk about millimeter wave. Hi, Finbar. How are you?
Hey, Mariam. Great. Good to be with you again.
Fantastic. So a little while ago, you announced the Dimensity 1050, which is the first chip from MediaTek with millimeter wave. And so this is exciting, I think, for our market. But in general, I kind of wanted to get a feel for what the chip brings to the table, how it positions in the, you know, broad Dimensity lineup, and then, you know, what we can expect in terms of millimeter wave goodness.
Yeah, no, it's an exciting announcement from our side. I mean, it's been a long time coming. You know, I think we've talked about our millimeter wave technology development for a while. We've sort of signaled that this smartphone SoC was coming, so we're delighted to have launched it. You know, as the number suggests, it's positioned sort of in the high end of our portfolio, you know, below the premium and the flagship segments that we've talked about before, like the 9000 and the 8000. But I think most significant is, you know, as you said, the inclusion of the full millimeter wave, you know, 5G release 16 capability as part of the platform. So very focused on kind of the North American market for obvious reasons, where millimeter wave is most deployed today, you know, and also I think helps MediaTek move, you know, into higher tiers of the US market than we've probably been in the past.
Yeah, I think this is a great opportunity. That's kind of why I was like, wow, okay. Tell us a little bit how the chip fits in. Like, obviously, there's Dimensity 1200, there's 11, there's 10 or 1000, I should say. So, like, you know how sometimes because you release a chip, then 2 years go by, right? So you can't really compare, like, say, the 1200 necessarily to maybe a new 1000 level chip. So where does it fit in, you think, in terms of performance and specs right now?
I mean, I think for kind of the end devices and where it'll end up, it's going to be in the realm of the 1000, 1200, 1300 series. You know, there probably will be some differences in the performance, but, you know, it's a 6-nanometer product, so still advanced technology. You know, low power. It's a 2+6 CPU configuration, octa-core.
Okay.
You know, but it supports 4K video, you know, 108 megapixel peak camera capability. What we've also done with this particular product is we've brought a lot of the technology from our flagship and premium devices, so the 9000 and the 8000 series, down. So when you look at the camera specs, the APU specs, the GPU specs, it's literally the same IP. Now we scale it back a little bit. So it, you know, for example, in the camera, we support, you know, two hardware video HDR pipelines. Whereas in the premium and flagships, like, we've supported up to three, for example. You know, it's got the same graphics IP as the Mali 8000, but less multi-cores, right? So it leverages a lot of the architecture. It leverages a lot of the technology from the higher end products, you know, just scaled for, you know, those price points rather than at the premium tiers.
So what are those price points you think you were going to achieve in the US? Are you looking like the 500 or 300?
I think it's probably, you know, 400 or 500, something like that, right? So, yeah, you know, there's
four to six, right?
Yeah, something in that range, I think. Again, obviously, those decisions we leave to our customers with the product configurations.
You have no control over that.
Yeah, but that seems the appropriate sweet spot. You know, it's also sort of where millimeter wave is important. Again, different carriers in the US, I think, have different breakpoints for where millimeter wave is mandated. But that's kind of the range, we think, right? So it's not the super high end, and it's certainly not the entry tiers. It's more that kind of mid-high range.
But it's interesting to me that you're bringing in some of the tech from the higher end chips back down. That's kind of what I meant. Like, you know, 2 years have gone by since the introduction of the 1000 more series, and here we are with some of that trickle-down technology, which is really exciting because it gives the customer, the user at the end on their device, a much better experience for imaging, for, you know, AI processing and whatever. So at the core, we're looking at a true and true mid-range chip with the latest and the best that MediaTek can provide, right?
I mean, I think that's always what we've tried to do as MediaTek, right? Which is to focus on the user experience. You know, obviously we've had 2 years of major technology development on all the different technology fronts that you talked about. And we try to leverage those as much as we can. Of course, you know, at the flagship, you can obviously do a lot more in terms of performance, but then the price points are different. So it's kind of finding that balance between bringing the right IP at the right performance level for that tier is what we're trying to do here.
So in terms of radio, this has all the standard 5G you've brought to the table to date, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then it adds the millimeter wave support. How broad is that millimeter wave support? Are you specifically targeting the US market, or are you going to be able to use this in Japan, for example, if you're a manufacturer?
Yep. So yes, it's just to summarize for the listeners, it's, you know, our latest M80 release 16 modem. It includes, you know, certainly some enhancements on the sub 6 side as well. So for example, we've added support for up to 3 carrier aggregation and up to 200 megahertz of aggregated bandwidth. So that's sort of useful for the US carriers as well, who have more fragmented sub 6 spectrum and want to be able to aggregate more carriers, you know, particularly as C-band gets rolled in. But then we've also added up to 400 megahertz, so 4 carriers by 100 of millimeter wave spectrum.
Wow.
So to answer your question, yes, our first priority has been focused on the US. So we're pretty much through the interoperability testing with all the major US carriers. But we are also focused on doing some interoperability testing with the Japanese carriers. You know, as we've sort of discussed before, the rollout of millimeter wave has really been very concentrated just in the US. We don't see it very broadly in any other markets really yet. But, you know, perhaps Japan will start to have some rollouts. So we're starting to prepare for that. So those are probably our two main focus areas for where the millimeter wave technology will be deployed.
I mean, the cynic in me is busy going to say there's really one carrier in the US, right? I mean, we all know they have millimeter wave base stations and deployed in markets. But frankly, when I talk to the carriers right now, T-Mobile and AT&T never even bring it up anymore. And some of their devices support it, but you pretty much have to go to the high end to get it. Whereas I think Verizon is obviously pushing it a lot harder and is providing devices now that cost, you know, as low as $300 with millimeter wave. So, which is, I think, kind of surprising that they're even pushing that. Like, I'm not sure that a customer paying for a $300 phone necessarily needs it. But I think at the $500 price point, as you said, I think it's a kind of like you can get into the premium mid-range / affordable flagship range if you go to $600. And then, you know, it's a really nice perk for a carrier, in this case Verizon, I would suppose, to say things like, hey, you're getting the best that we can bring to you if you have that available. And, you know, you don't have to rely on the competition for the chipset. So I think to me, that's a huge, huge plus for everyone. We're all benefiting here, right?
Yeah, no, I think you've nailed it, right? I mean, we've always said that, you know, we didn't think that millimeter wave was going to be the mainstream 5G technology. And, you know, if you look at the, even today, right, 2022, probably at best 10% of the 5G devices globally, you know, support millimeter wave, right? So 90% of the 5G devices are still sub 6, which is where we put our first focus. But that said, you know, the North American market continues to be an important focus for us. You know, we have steadily gained market share in North America, you know, perhaps even taking the number one position in Android over the last year. But we would also acknowledge that most of MediaTek's customers' volumes in the North American market have been in the entry mid-range devices, you know, kind of the prepaid segments, you know, which is a very important volume segment in the US.
Oh,
but,
for sure.
But for us to continue to gain share with our customers in the North American market, millimeter wave technology becomes essential, certainly for carriers like Verizon, as you mentioned, who are, you know, continuing to deploy and focus on, you know, the millimeter wave technology. But also, you know, our customers tend to platform their products across different different segments and different tiers. So, for example, you know, a certain category may be required for Verizon, but perhaps at that price point, not for other carriers. But if we can't support Verizon's requirements with millimeter wave for that customer slot, you know, we kind of get excluded from all of them, right? So it is important technology.
Exactly.
It is important for our customers that we're able to deliver that technology, you know, and frankly, bring some competition to that part of the market as well.
Oh, it's so critical. And then, you know, I think the other part too is that if the two carriers in the US decide, hey, we want to broaden our millimeter wave portfolio, and now we want to deliver some devices that are, you know, more affordable than the iPhones and Galaxies of the world, like I'm talking about the flagships, then we have that option of making a phone that works on our networks that is more affordable for our customers. I think that's critical. Tell me what the thought process is. I think we kind of already answered it, but I kind of want to know from you. Like, you know, I was actually at first surprised, but now that I've talked to you a few times about this, it makes more sense. But I thought it would come out millimeter wave on a flagship chip first. For some reason, I was like, because of the cost, I was like thinking maybe it's just not cost effective to do a 1,000 level chip, but the 8 or 9,000 would be a good candidate. So I'm sure you've kind of already answered it, but I'm more wondering where the, you know, what MediaTek's take is on that.
Yeah, I mean, that would probably have been the quote unquote traditional playbook. But actually, right. You know, when you sort of step back and look at it, you know, for us, it was pretty easy to position millimeter wave where we positioned it, right? Again, and I admit it's not probably the logical place to have it. But, you know, when you look at the market, A, millimeter wave, still really a US requirement. You know, B, when you look at the US market, you know, Apple in particular, but also, you know, Samsung, Galaxy tend to be kind of the dominant volume players at the flagship and the premium tier for, you know, all the reasons we understand. You know, those were, you know, at this point, not credible targets for MediaTek, I think it's fair to say. But so when we kind of look at the overlay of the market, you know, our customer base, where we were coming from in the US, as I mentioned, sort of moving up tier, you know, it made sense to kind of move from kind of the entry mid range into the mid high range, you know, this $300 to $500 range that we were talking about. So that's where we tried to position the Dimensity 1050. So it's, you know,
right.
But again, as we mentioned, you know, we do our best to leverage some of the premium and flagship technology and bring that down. You know, it's also a fairly time consuming, and we've talked about it before, but a fairly long and time consuming process, you know, to go through all the interoperability testing with the infrastructure vendors, the operators. So we needed some time to do that. But now that we've done that, we can obviously leverage the millimeter wave capability into other segments going forward if we need to or want to for customer demand, etc. So you'll probably see it showing up in more devices in the future. But again, we still take the view that, you know, sub-6 is the dominant technology. You know, that's going to be around for a long time. But millimeter wave will be needed in certain places, as we've talked about.
No, that's great. How do you see this proliferating into the entire portfolio, if it indeed does? My thought here is looking beyond the US, for example, in China, where you're very popular with the high-end chips right now. You've got the Dimensity 9000 and 8100 appearing on some really amazing devices, especially like the Realme GT Neo 3 and then there was the, of course, the Find X5 Pro, right? And I'm wondering, those don't really need millimeter wave. So will they eventually just have it like Qualcomm has it on their devices? And then you're just going to be able to pick and choose? Or are we going to be more strategic about it? Are you just going to make some chips that might be a little more affordable that have no millimeter wave because it's just not required in that market, right?
I think it'll, yeah, I mean, I think you hit some good points, Miriam. We're delighted with the success of the 8100 and the Dimensity 8000, right? I mean, they seem to be sort of, you know, setting a new bar for performance in that kind of premium tier. And our Dimensity 9000, I think, has got off to a great start in the flagship tier, but we have more work to do there. And that's going to be a multi-year journey, as we've said before. But yes, we made the decision to not include millimeter wave in those products. Because for the markets that, you know, we felt and the OEMs that were going to target those tier of devices with those platforms, you know, millimeter wave technology wasn't required. I think it's fair to say that, you know, it's more likely that millimeter wave will show up in higher tier products going forward. Like you said, sort of just so that it's available. You know, if we continue to gain higher end market share in the US, that can also be a factor. So I think for sure, you know, we'll probably see it in more high-end devices as we go forward. And, you know, possibly in other devices in this tier for the US market in the future. You know, I think it will be one of those features that may or may not get populated by OEMs on specific devices, even on specific SKUs. But having it, I think, becomes important for certain tiers. So I think that's what you can expect from us in the future.
Yeah, and I think the fact that you've got it certified now, it's going to make it easier to certify future chips because, you know, you're no longer an unknown. I mean, we've all known and been confident that it wasn't going to be an issue. Come on, you guys have been doing this forever. It's more like, you know, the carriers are a little finicky and, you know, and it's fair, you know, they're trying to kind of control their own little universe.
But we're also, you know, very happy with the performance that we've been able to achieve with this first generation of millimeter wave technology, both in terms of, you know, the size of our millimeter wave antenna modules, you know, the RF performance, the power consumption. You know, I think it's going to surprise people how well it performs when we start seeing the devices.
Right. Let's talk about that because you did release your own millimeter wave antenna for this as well, right?
Correct. Yep.
Tell us about it. I know this is super nerdy, but I think our audience is just going to love it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, so yes, traditionally, you know, from the millimeter or from the sub six and the 4G side, you know, MediaTek's chipset will really go to the what we call the RF transceiver. And then we work with all of our partners, you know, the usual Skyworks, Qorvo, Murata, you know, companies for the RF front end. So the PAs, the switches, the duplexers, all that kind of thing for the sub six frequency bands. For millimeter wave, it's a little bit more complicated, right? Because it's obviously much higher frequencies. You know, the let's say the linkage from the antenna to the baseband becomes so much more critical. So yeah, we had to develop in-house antenna modules. So these are basically very small modules that have the antennas that detect the millimeter wave frequencies, whether it's 28 or 39 gigs. And then convert them down to intermediate frequencies and then down to the baseband. So we supply a full chipset all the way to the antenna for the millimeter wave frequencies. You know, we expect, you know, we've architected the platform to support up to four antenna modules, but, you know, probably two to three is probably going to be the more normal configuration for handsets of these right. antenna modules, you know, and these are typically placed in different parts of the industrial design. So, you know, the idea is if your hand is covering one of them as you're holding the phone, yeah. you can use another antenna module. So yeah, we've, you know, that's all in-house technology, all developed at MediaTek. Of course, we work with partners to develop the modules. But, you know, the ICs, the architecture, the full end-to-end solution comes from MediaTek.
That's awesome. I mean, it's always nice when you can provide the entire chain, right? I think that's also the key is like you give competition, not just at the chip level, you give competition at the entire, you know, process. So the manufacturers have choices and they can say, well, you know, we want to use this process and this antenna or whatever, right? And I think that to me seems like a kind of a critical part because you're just giving people what they need, right? And people being the manufacturers and even the carriers might have really special requirements on that. Who knows?
But yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, cool. Listen, I think we've kind of covered everything here. I feel like this is a pretty big deal. And I kind of glad you and I were able to talk about it. Having you on the show for this is just like so awesome. So,
and we got to geek out a little bit on millimeter wave, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It's so fun. Thanks again. And hope to have you back on the show soon.
Always a pleasure, Mariam. Great to be here. Thank you.
Take care. And I have Ed with me now, Ed Hardy, Cult of Mac. Hi, Ed. How are you?
Doing well. Tired after WWDC, but good.
I bet. That was a marathon of, you know, every time they do the keynote, I feel like I'm watching a hockey game. Like, I can't keep up with the puck. It's like, wait, what? And I'll tell you how bad it was for me, even though I was paying attention. I completely missed the MacBook Pro M2.
Well,
I actually didn't even know it existed until I had a conversation on Twitter later with someone who said, oh, yeah. And I'm like, wait, what? So I had to go and have a look.
Right. I mean, if something exciting happens, like the MacBook Air with M2, you can be excited for that. And then they've moved on. So, you know, if you come back 2 minutes later, you've missed some other big announcement.
Exactly. So what's your take overall on this WWDC 22. I feel like we got a lot of good meat. I think I'm very happy with what they've announced. Anything that stood out for you overall? For me, it's going to be the MacBook Air M2, of course.
I'm an iPad first person. So for me, the biggest thing from WWDC is the iPad. They've come up with a new multitasking system with floating app windows. It's very similar to what is available on the Mac OS. And it's kind of a sea change for the iPad, especially for people who want to use it as a laptop. And that includes full external display support, which is really a game changer. I mean, the 13-inch screen is something that you can get work done on, but there's limited, it really limits you to two applications, practically speaking. Now you can have 8 with a bunch of them on an external display. So it's the iPad just got a lot more, of a productivity focus.
Yeah. And, I'm actually surprised that this didn't happen before. Like, I've always been, for me, the iPad's problem as a user for me has been the lack of windowing and multitasking. I mean, it does it, of course, but even on phones that support it, like the iPhone and a lot of Android phones, especially the big screen Android phones, the folding phones, I cannot get my mindset around multitasking beyond flipping apps to the foreground, right? Like, I just flip apps to the foreground. I've got them running. I keep track in my head of what's running and I flip between them. But, once you start getting more screen real estate, like on a computer with a real, OS and a display that's bigger than 7 inches, you start wanting to, I think, window stuff. And the challenge is, how do you do that well, right? With a touch-based OS. I totally get why they limited things the way they did. But for me, that was always one of the things with the iPad that held me back from jumping in and using it wholeheartedly, right? They fixed other stuff since then, like the lack of trackpad support was another one for me. And that's fixed now as of, 2 years ago or something? But I feel like for me, it's really the multitasking windowing approach that I was missing. And I'm curious to hear your take on how they're doing it so that it's so easy to use. So they're using, what do they call that technology? It's also on Ventura on the Mac OS, right? It's that used to be Spaces, but what is it called now?
Center Stage.
Center Stage. So wait, it's the same name as on the camera system?
No. It's Stage Manager. See, I'm getting it
confused. See, there you go. Okay.
It's too close to each other. Center Stage and Stage Manager, it's poor choice of branding.
Okay, Stage Manager makes sense, but it's strange to me because on the Mac, they've reinvented this, which is basically a window managing system, which, Unix has had for years, Linux has because it's Unix, and Mac has because it's Unix. But they keep changing it and renaming it, and I don't understand why they can't settle on one thing or keep the name they have and just evolve it. Like, it changes from generation to generation. They have to rename it. So Stage Manager, how is that different from Spaces, first of all, on the Mac, to give us context? And then how do we go from there to Stage Manager on the iPad, and how different is it there?
I believe one of the goals of Stage Manager is to give you the option of having your Mac and your iPad work almost identically for people who switch back and forth. If you use a desktop Mac all day, and then you pick up your iPad, it's frustrating to you that it doesn't work the same way. And keep in mind that Stage Manager is, even on the Mac, is also an option. You can continue to use it the way you use your Mac the way you always have, or you can invoke Stage Manager, which is a little bit like windowing with, perhaps, I don't know if I want to call it training wheels, but it's trying to, rather than giving you the full windowing, you're all on your own, it's trying to help you, help you arrange your windows in a more logical manner in the way that Apple likes it, because that's kind of the company that Apple is. It's like, we want to help you do things, not just make you do things on your own.
So I think from what I'm understanding what you're saying is they wanted to do this on the iPad and they wanted to create something that mimicked what was going on the Mac. And so they renamed the Mac version and tweaked it, whatever Spaces. And before that, it was called something else. I can't even remember what it's called in the early version of OS X. I've been using OS X since Tiger. So I don't I don't remember. Anyway, the point is that it's exciting to me. Like, this makes me want to almost go and try an iPad out again, simply because I know I can get more productive now. It's not that I use the multi-window stuff that much even on my Mac, but it's nice to have, especially when I'm doing things like some apps I'm liking full screen. Like, I use, you know, my web browser full screen. I'm not a multi-monitor person in general, because I travel so much. I'm used to having just a smaller single screen, and I'm very good at managing my spaces. But I feel like, you know, the challenge is more like when you want to drag and drop stuff between two windows, you need two smaller windows. And the drag and drop is sometimes way more efficient than, you know, copy and paste or typing a command line. I'm also pretty apt with command lines. I can totally don't mind managing the file system, which you don't have to worry about on an iPad, but on a Mac you have with a bunch of commands. But I find that if I'm
that's old school.
Yeah, I find that if I'm on a Mac, usually in Finder, for example, I do everything in smaller windows. I have like 4, 5, 6 smaller windows open at any given time that are kind of my contextual, like, this is the area where these files are, this is the area where these files are, especially when I'm doing audio editing and stuff. Like, I'm actually actively pushing pixels, as it were, you know, literally moving data around my computer. And you know, I know that the ultimate goal with the iPad is for that not to exist. You don't have to worry about it. It just is completely virtualized for you. But the reality is, you know, Mac is pickup truck. You know, iPad is normal everyday car.
Right.
So pickup truck, obviously, you want to be able to get in the nitty gritty. But I feel like this is a huge step. So I agree with you. If I have to pick something from the iPad announcements, for me, it's definitely Stage Manager.
Because the new MacBook Air is great, but it's not really WWDC. I mean, they could have had that announcement last week or next week. It's a hardware announcement.
For sure. But I'm a big hardware person. So, you know, I understand the software is super critical. I mean, it's what makes the hardware shine. But, you know, and this is obviously a developer conference, so I had to get that. That's kind of why I wanted you, Helen, because I know I read your stories on Cult of Mac. So I'm like, I know you're the guy to go to kind of have an analysis on the features and the experience. And for me, it's always like, you know, what hardware did Apple announce and what's the nitty gritty bits in there? And so we're going to get to that, folks. We're going to get to that.
I will suggest that the reason you're more excited about the MacBook Air than you are about the than Mac OS Ventura is Mac OS is a really mature operating system. There's just not that much that they can do to it now that's like, oh my God, they have changed the Mac forever. They have already changed the Mac forever, and that was about 20 years ago.
And
so honestly, what matters now is hardware.
100%. And honestly, I feel like, you know, again, I'm more of a Mac user than iOS user, so iPad OS, since I kind of lumped them together because for a long time they were the same, right? They didn't separate the names until a while back. But I feel like, you know, I see how many people use their iPads. Like, I see people like Harry McCracken, who are journalists, who exclusively use the iPad for all their work, like you do, right?
I do.
And so I know it's a thing, and I don't want to dismiss that. I feel it's critical to a lot of people. And so when I see features that come from my pickup truck and go back to the normal car, I get excited, right? So that's kind of where I'm at with that. But for me, in terms of software, if I had to look at the entire, like putting aside the MacBook Air M2, the thing that struck out the most, it's kind of a toss between the camera continuity feature.
It's cool.
On iOS and the new Apple CarPlay iOS features. Because as you know, I'm a huge car enthusiast and I review particularly specifically EVs. And because, you know, you got to pick something. There's so many cars out there. And car tech. And it's kind of amazing to me that this announcement was made, because I know how the car industry works and the car industry is backwards. Like, trust me, tech is a delight to report about, because at least everyone is more or less on the same page. You know, there are differences in opinion on how things should be done. There's lots of philosophical debate around open source versus closed source, blah, 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 of course, all that. But you go in the car world, they don't get software. They don't understand it. And unless you're Tesla or Rivian or you know, Lucid, who are brand new startups who are making incredible cars, but are primarily software companies first that happen to be making some incredible hardware as well. In similar ways to Apple, software company first that happens to be making some incredible hardware as well. Unless you look at them, the infotainment systems, even the ones that have really been, you know, sweated on and researched and iterated and worked on, and you can see they did the work, like Mercedes, for example, it's not to the caliber of these other startups, these either the new kids on the block. And so to me, this is why this is such an important announcement. On one hand, I don't see this flying at all. I don't see how car manufacturers would let Apple get that much control over the user experience of a car. But at the same time, they are stuck. They don't know how to evolve this fast enough to make it their own. Like, I was talking to someone, who was it? I think it was Mercedes, actually. And they were telling me, like, they have like a team of 1,000 people reinventing things like search. Like, they want to own everything. They want to, like, because they understand that, you know, to get a good experience, you need the hardware and the software. So they're working with partners like Google for search of the internet, but they're trying as much as possible to keep stuff in-house. They're working with mapping partners to just get the map data, but not actually do the routing and stuff. Like, it's crazy to me how much they're trying to reinvent the wheel. But at the same time, I understand where they're coming from. They're like, we can only provide a good experience if we own the whole thing, and like Apple does. And at the same time, I'm like, there's no way you can ever get good enough to catch up with the Googles and Apples and Teslas of the world there, right?
So I feel like we're at a funny space, because Apple is trying to do the exact opposite, which is they've got all the software and they are trying to build the hardware, and it's turning out to be immensely complicated.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not, you don't just put a car together the same way you put a MacBook together. And at the and very least, they've got, you know, 25, 30 years experience building notebooks. So now they're good at it. And they've got they've never launched a car. So I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know whether somebody's going to break down and actually let, you know, whether the software people are going to let the hardware people have some control or vice versa. I don't know. I mean, we've already heard that Apple can't get anybody to work with them on an Apple car because they want to control the hardware. I mean, they want it to be an Apple car. It is not going to be the Apple / I don't know who was it, not Huawei,
Sony, or whatever,
Hyundai. Hyundai bailed out because they wanted it to be an Apple car, and they're like, no, it's going to be a Hyundai. They're like, no, it's not. And right. Hyundai's like, we're out.
Yeah, and I think as such, this is could go very wrong and very right. Like, Apple CarPlay is very good; it does its job. I think Android Auto is very good too. It does its job. It gives you a familiar interface. If you have multiple cars or you rent cars a lot, it's a blessing because you don't have to just worry about Bluetooth, but you can actually worry about a relatively unified user experience, at least on the infotainment system, when you have one or the other running. So great. But what Apple's trying to do here, folks, if you haven't been looking and reading the articles, I will link to some stories in the show notes. I'm assuming as you're listening to this, a few days after the announcements, that you, my audience, have read up on this. But Apple is going to want the manufacturers to let them control climate and other car systems from CarPlay, and vice versa, grab data from the CAN bus, which is the kind of universal network bus system that cars use these days, to display a dashboard, to display instruments. And so that, to me, I don't see that flying. I can see some car manufacturers being on board because of the clout of the announcement, but they didn't announce, first of all, any companies specifically. They just said coming to cars later in 23, and that's fine. But knowing the Germans, for example, and even the Japanese, Toyota has had to reinvent from scratch their infotainment system this past year, and they've done a phenomenal job after doing terrible user experiences for years. They took it out of Japan into the US and said, let's the US software people do this, because they're actually going to listen to the feedback of the user, whereas Japan always has their own idea of what should happen. And the result has been a resounding success. If you drive one of the two or three new Toyotas that have this thing, or Lexi, whatever, that have this thing, you're going to be impressed. I was impressed. It's still not as good as Tesla or Lucid or Rivian, but you know, it's the same with Mercedes. Their stuff is really solid, but it's still not good enough. So then you're like thinking to yourself, if I'm the average Joe, right, buy a car and I get access to this technology, I have an iPhone and I plug this into my, say, BMW, and all of a sudden my entire car changes, all the displays are driven by my iPhone, what does that mean about my BMW experience? Is that still a BMW experience? Because I'm sorry, I'm a driver, I'm an enthusiast. Now, the average person doesn't care, they just want to go from point A to point B. But I think people who buy certain brands want that brand's car experience. They don't want just the sensation of how the car feels and drives. They also want the user experience. They're familiar with the switches, the positions. Like when I get into a Porsche from 30 years ago, it feels exactly the same as getting into a brand new Porsche with all the digital stuff. Why? Because all the points are exactly in the same place. I'm not talking about the controls. I'm just talking about the way I'm sitting, the height of the dashboard, the position of the steering wheel, the position of the pedals, where the center console is, where my door grip is. It's uncanny. And that's why people like those cars, because if they're enthusiasts, they have familiarity. So I don't know where we're going with this. On one hand, I'm super excited because I think this makes sense. For a lot of people, this is the way to go. But I don't know if the car industry can weather this storm. Like, I don't see them being on board.
So we can't have this conversation without bringing up, I mean, what's... And I'm hardly the only person to make this observation. If nothing else, the announcement of what they had is a backdoor into what the Apple Car's cabin is going to look like. If nobody else uses this, Apple is. And again, you should look at this on the in the webpages you look up. But it is a single rectangular console that goes from the left side of the driver to the right side of the passenger. It is the entire dashboard of the car. So this is not a subtle thing that you can pop into your current design, but everyone is guessing that that's what the Apple Car is going to look like. You're gonna sit down, and this is what you're gonna see. So if you're wondering what the interior of the Apple Car looks like, that.
And to be frank, there are a few cars on the market today that have essentially that right now: Mercedes EQS, Lucid Air, Porsche Taycan are literally almost three seamless displays: instrument, center, and passengers get their own display with their own computer, right, and their own entertainment, their own Bluetooth stack, so they can listen with earbuds or headphones to their own stuff separately. Why would they need that when they have an iPhone in their pocket? You see, that's the thing I don't understand. It's like every time I get into a Mercedes, they're great cars, and especially the new ones, the electric ones, those screens, they have this hyperscreen, 56 inches, three displays. It just spans the entire dashboard. Amazing. But why does the passenger even need an infotainment? What the passenger needs is controls for their seats, for maybe navigation, so they can see where the car is going, But they don't necessarily need to navigate. They have their phone for that. They don't necessarily need to listen to entertainment or content because they have their phone for that. And I say iPhone, but it could be anything. And so I don't know. Like, I'm not saying they shouldn't have a display for the passenger. I'm just saying that, again, it makes sense to see Apple's vision of everything being under their purview, because then you can control the user experience. But I don't see the manufacturers letting it happen. So I'm just conflicted about the whole thing. I think it's fascinating. The other thing I want to bring up, and we can have an entire podcast about this, but the safety implications. You cannot have your iPhone crash ever at all if these things are displaying instrument data. There are some things like airbag lights and stuff that need to be always present and always available and display at any time. So those things today are bulletproof because the car makers are using like essentially military grade components and displays and processors on their cars. It has to be able to survive temperatures of 120 degrees in the cabin. Now, the phone doesn't have to do that. It's on your pocket. But it cannot fail while you're driving. None of this can break. None of this can pause. None of this can freeze. Yeah. And I've used Apple CarPlay enough in cars now that half the time, it dumps in the middle of it and I have to replug my phone or reconnect. And I'm not sure how they're going to achieve that.
Again, it's going to be a whole thing. I feel like it's going to have to be a hybrid system. Some of it is going to run, like the dash, is the instruments are going to be run by the car. So it's going to, and that's going to go in collaboration with what's running on your iPhone. Or perhaps your iPhone will just, rather than your, currently the dash is like an external screen for your iPhone. Perhaps in the new vision, your iPhone will become an external screen for your dash. It will let you, everything's actually going to run on the car and you'll just, it'll look like you're still running the music app, but really what you're running is a remote control.
And that might be the solution, or it falls back instantly to the normal display of the car's system.
Right.
Right? If it crashes, which I think would be the alternative. And, you know, I own a Tesla and it sometimes does crash, like, but not the car computers, not the actual computers that do the driving and controlling of the actual car, the display computers, right? The actual center screen infotainment, which is the only thing on a Model 3. There's no instrument panel. And it crashes not like, I've had it go dark, but it'll instantly reboot and 5, 10 seconds later, it's back. But there's, during the time it's dead, you can still drive the car, but you don't even hear the blinkers because the sound is actually triggered. You know, the tick sound is being made by the sound system. You don't see your speed. You can control the HVAC. You can control some basic things, of course, the gears, because that's done on the stock. The turn signal is done on the stock, on the wheel. You can control like the hazards. There's a special button for that. But it's really interesting. And you can manually reboot it too. If you're ever in a Tesla, if you hold the two scroll wheels on the steering wheel for more than 30 seconds, you're going to reboot the infotainment system. You're not rebooting the car. You're just rebooting the actual display. It's interesting. But, you know, this is the world we live in, folks. Like, a lot of people are like, I would never want a car like that. You know what? It's my fourth year with a Tesla. It's my second one. You don't even care. Like, it's such a great experience in every other way that it doesn't matter.
Hey, we live in a funny world. I myself have said the sentence, hold on, honey. I'm updating the operating system on the lamp.
Right. It's crazy. All right. So that's what stands out for me for iOS. I think the other one is continuity camera. And that to me is really exciting because we have this product. It exists as an app today on Android and iOS and lets you turn an older, usually an older, because you don't want to use your own phone necessarily, iOS or Android device you have in a drawer that might be a year or two old. If you're like me, you know, you have a lot of devices because you review them. But a lot of my tech savvy listeners at least update their phones every year. And you want a much better webcam than what you have. So you can mount your phone on a tripod behind your laptop or somewhere in your desk area and then run the software on your iPhone or your Android and then connects to your, you know, PC or Mac and it gives you access. It looks like a webcam to your computer. Great. Apple just made this instantly seamless with macOS Ventura and iOS 16. And it just blows my mind because it's, again, one of those things we've had forever in a way, we've had for a while, that Apple is just making completely seamless, right?
Right. That is the benefit of the hardware, software, you know, complete control from one company is you don't have to jump through the hoops that a third-party company does in order to do this. It can just be, it's fully integrated. And it is kind of amazing. I'm also impressed with, and I would love to see this in real life. It's you put the phone up on, you know, you've got your Mac screen, your computer screen, and you put the phone on top of that. And it can show you an overhead of something that's right in front of you. So that what it's getting is an extremely distorted picture of what's directly in front of you. And then it is then modifying that extremely distorted picture as though it were pointing straight down.
100%. It's using the ultra wide camera to do that. And it's just basically image processing, but I'm glad you pointed out because that was my next thing I was going to mention. I'm like, that's another thing that I don't think I've seen on the other pieces of software. And so, you know, I have an old iPhone and I'm going to try it out as soon as I get Ventura and iOS 16. Like, this is incredible. This is a game changer because especially for me who does a video podcast, for those of you listening on audio, there is a video version of the show on Patreon, patreon.com/TNKJRL. That's patreon.com/tankerl, like my handle on Twitter. If you want to watch the video version, one of the tiers is that. So, you know, I always struggle because I travel so much. Like the webcam here on my MacBook Air M1 is pretty solid in good light. I'm in front of a window right now, so it's nice. But those of you who watch me record in my studio at home in San Francisco on my iMac have noticed that I use a third-party webcam, and it's better than the iMac's webcam, but I still have issues with lighting. It's still not perfect. And, you know, iPhone would just solve the problem.
Right. I mean, the best camera possible is the one that you have with you.
Yeah.
And this is kind of an acknowledgement that webcams are kind of lame. And there's really not much you can buy. And, you know, when people use their MacBooks forever, you know, there's nothing you can do about, you know, you decide 3 years after you bought a MacBook that you really wish you'd got a better webcam for it. I mean, and now you don't have to go buy an external one. You've got one because you already own it. There's no reason to own seven cameras.
No. Oh, I think this is great stuff. I'm not much of a watchOS person. So very briefly, because I want to talk about the hardware now, tell us about what watchOS brings to the table that's got you excited.
So watchOS is an interesting product in that it's an exercise thing. It is not primarily what I use it for, but that is what's driving it right now. And all of the new features coming in the new version of watchOS are really helping people who do a lot of exercise even better. I mean, there right. are up to and including, you know, better ways to help you swim because the device is designed for you to swim in it. You know, better workouts, you know, very, very, very detailed data, you know, data-driven exercise. This is not I ran 7 miles, but, you know, in my stride, my feet are on the ground for, you know, 0.8 seconds. And, you know, studies show that it'd be better if it were more or less than that. So I need to adjust my stride. And here I've got the data to prove it. And that's where we are.
Yeah.
I am a watchOS user, but as kind of a third screen sort of thing. I love it for it, you know, when I'm driving, I've got my GPS going and I love that the watch, you know, vibrates at me to tell me that there's a turn coming up so I don't miss it. I mean, that's the basic, you know, use that's great for me. And it already does that. So, you know, there's nothing coming in watchOS that is going to make that better. Or I love that it gives me when I'm away from my computer, I get a Slack notification that tells me, you know, that I've got a message and I can look at my watch and go, okay, this is somebody asking me a question that I don't have to answer right now.
Yep. Triage.
That's the killer app for me because it keeps me from having to run back to my computer to find out that somebody sent me a joke. But I mean, if you are hardcore exercising and you're getting by with a Fitbit, I think you're missing out on a lot of the capabilities.
100%. And that's how I use my smartwatches as well. OC has notification devices and basic step tracking, sleep tracking, and health tracking, but not like I'm not a right. workout person, so it's not that big of a deal to me. What about Ventura? So obviously we've talked about some of the features. I think for me, the stage manager, is that?
That is it. We got it right this time.
Oh, yeah. Stage Manager is obviously a big feature. What stands out other than Stage Manager for you on Ventura, which is an interesting name because, you know, Ventura is, I don't know, it's not the first place that comes to mind for me, considering they've been using kind of more nature-themed names.
Yes, it was
Ventura
surprising.
Ventura is a city, right, in just northwest of LA. It's really nice. It's just at the foothills. It's like close to Santa Barbara. It's not very far from, you know, LA. And it's just not far from Malibu either. It's an interesting choice. But anyway.
So I got to be honest, and I'll probably be burned in effigy by MacBook users. So in the WWDC keynote, we got to the Mac portion and they announced two new MacBooks. And then they got to what's going on with macOS, which indicates that this is not a big year for macOS.
No.
I feel like some years, Apple has limited bandwidth And some years it's an iPad year, some years it's an iPhone year, and some years it's a Mac year. This was an iPad year. It's not a Mac year. I mean, they've got some nice stuff. The continuity camera is great, but.
Yeah. But again, it touched in the same way as Stage Manager touches on the iPad.
Yes, the Stage Manager.
The continuity camera touches on the iOS, right? It's more, these are more companion Mac features. You know, now that I think of it, Monterey, which I still haven't installed. Yes, I am still in Big Sur, is also a city. So maybe they are switching to cities instead of nature locales like Big Sur and, you know,
but
El Capitan and all these other ones.
Right. To be clear, that doesn't, you know, some people say that, you know, Apple doesn't care about the Mac anymore. It's all about, iPhone. That is not true. It just means that 2022 is not a Big Mac year. That doesn't say anything about what's going to happen in 2023.
But I think it's going to be a Big Mac year because we have to talk about the elephant in the room, the thing that made my WWDC 22, and that new MacBook Air M2. Look, I'll be honest with you, Ed. I didn't think they're going to launch this there because to me, as an ex-developer, somebody who used to write software for a living in video games, I never think of developer conferences like the public does, right? It's about, you know, networking with fellow colleagues and coming up with new tricks and tips and learning. And it's not about like, ooh, shiny new hardware. Even when I worked in video games, you know, you didn't have Sony and Microsoft launching an Xbox at their developer conferences. Sometimes they would announce some new feature or give us a kind of a preview or behind curtains. But the point is, you know, I should be more aware of that as an ex-dev, but the hardware is so delightful. And I was expecting an M2 Mac Mini, frankly. That's what I thought they would start with.
I agree.
And then we got the full enchilada in a way. I mean, I was ready to buy a MacBook Pro recently. Not that I really need that kind of power. My M1 MacBook Air is phenomenal. It's almost a year and a half, 2 years old almost. I bought it a month after it came out. And I've got the 8-core. I only have 8 gigs of RAM, but I know that with the memory management that ARM allows, I knew it would be plenty enough for me because I have 16 gigs on all my Intel Macs, and I actually feel that they struggle more with that in terms of number of tabs, for example, than 8 gig on an ARM-based M1. But I have the 512 gig storage because I need a lot of storage. And because of that, I got the 8-core GPU on mine, M1. So if I were to pick one right now, the M2, I would probably pick the 1499 model, whatever I think it is, the one with 512 gigs of storage, 8 gigs of RAM, and it comes with the dual port USB-C adapter. That's what I would pick, probably in that dark blackish color, because I generally pick the darker gray. Space gray, right? There's silver, space gray, some sort of gold, and some sort of black. So I might go black this time. I'm surprised I didn't do a rose gold because a lot of people I know love their MacBooks, especially Air, in rose gold.
I get it, but at the same time, colors are hard. You know, people don't want that color, and you can end up at the end with, you know, you've got to guess what colors people would prefer. And Apple's got a lot of experience in it. At the same time, you still get, you know, if it turns out that this year we're going to go pink, version, and everybody's going to love the pink one. And people do, but maybe people do know they don't want a pink MacBook. And then Apple winds up with a bunch of things that they've got to sell as refurbs.
Yeah.
And that's money out of Apple's pocket.
Interesting, though, that they didn't go with the color scheme from the iMac. I thought they were going to do that. I have a feeling that we're not going to get that for a while now because we just got a new MacBook Air and we get 4 colors and they're aluminum colors, which is fine. I mean, you can anodize aluminum to be purple if you want to, but I expected it to be more like iMac-like where some parts would be white. There might be a glass back instead of an aluminum cover. Although structurally it makes sense it's aluminum. I get it. Although, you know, again, glass can be used structurally. The glass roof on the Teslas is structural and it actually makes the car extremely strong in crash tests because it you know is very kind of rigid up to a certain point. You know, you get to a point where it it cracks and breaks. But until then, it's really holding the structure together tightly. So especially when it's slightly curved.
I have an engineering degree, so I have had a whole class in that. Strength of materials. So, you know. I know.
The point is, for me, what stands out here is obviously the chip, but, and this is going back to my initial point because I'm traveling all over the place here, but I was going to buy a MacBook Pro 14 simply because I wanted a bit more oomph and more ports, and the MagSafe was really exciting to me. But now I'm like, no, I'm getting an M2 100% as soon as it's available because, well, first of all, I don't need MagSafe. I'm not that non-clumsy, but it's nice to have. And most importantly, it frees up two ports for me to use for other things.
Yes.
But I feel like the whole computer as it is, I like fanless. And knowing what the M1 can dish out and having played with the M1 Pro and the M1 Max on some of the better Pro computers, I don't think I need that much horsepower. So M2, I think, would be the sweet spot for me. And it's interesting to me because if you're a heavy user like me, but not a complete, like I need the best, like I'm doing 8K video editing kind of work, why wouldn't you buy this over a MacBook Pro? Like a higher spec'd M2 Air, right? Especially now that it looks no longer like a wedge and it has the notch. So they're very similar looking.
When buying computers and also when buying expensive computers, people have the habit of going with buying a lot more computer than they need. Because they're with the attitude of, well, I might need this someday.
And it's like cars. Like, look, people buy an SUV because they're going to go to Home Depot once a year.
Yes, exactly. That is exactly what the attitude is. And like I mean, not to bring it around again. I argue for, you know, your average mom doesn't need anything more than an iPad with a keyboard attached to it. You don't. Yep. You're just never going to need the 57, you know, amazing extra things that your MacBook Pro can do, because you're just never going to do that. I think that's what sells MacBook Pros. Is like, well, the MacBook Air does everything that I need, but something might come up. I might need three ports. But you already touched on, I think, one of the biggest strengths of the Air is the MagSafe. And that's, it's not the whole, it won't knock you, you'll keep from knocking your laptop off. It's, you now have two ports completely available, and two ports is a huge change over one port. One port is not enough. And if one port is tied up with power, the other port has to do everything. It has to be your external monitor. It's got to be your external, plug in your external drives. It's asking it to do too much. Two, the way to go. Four is better, but two is enough.
Exactly. But it's also nice that now if you're traveling and you don't have your MacBook charger with you and your MagSafe connector, you can find a USB PD charger, plug it in, and you're charging off to the races. So this is kind of like the best of all worlds. And I know this has been the case with the MacBook Pro. This is not new. But I'm just saying this to me is the killer app. The other thing is the weight and size of this computer has got me very excited. It's not a huge difference, but it does look really thin when people hold it. And the weight on paper, knowing enough about having reviewed laptops and tablets and phones, you're going to notice it's lighter than the existing computer. And I think people are going to love that. And the fact that it's a squarish is it's a different design language. And I think it's time. As I said on the podcast before, I love the wedge. It was copied by everyone. The first PC manufacturer that got it and started making aluminum unibody wedge computers was Asus. But 6 months after the original, not the original, the Wedge Air, not the very first Air, which had a rounded bottom with the port door, which I bought and owned. But, you know, I feel like the PC world just mimicked, and now every computer is a wedge, for the average user, right? I'm not talking about the gaming computers or the creative pro computers. But it's interesting to me that they've decided to make the Air look more like the pros. And yes. I think that's kind of a message they're putting out there. They're like, we want you to think as this, maybe a more serious computer now. Maybe that's the message. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Part of the message is, this is an Apple computer and all Apple computers are going to look the same. From an iPhone to an iPad to a MacBook, they all have, as you say, they have the same general design language. To be I mean, the new Air looks great, but it also looks like two iPads sitting on top of each other.
Right. But so does the Pro, really, in a way, right?
But this one, I mean, really does. It genuinely looks like, because it's so slim. I keep meaning to do that, to look that up. Is it exactly the same size as two iPads sitting on top of each other? But I mean, that's not a knock. That's amazing.
100%. I think I'm really looking forward to this one. The one that puzzles me more, though, because we should probably move on to the other news, is the MacBook Pro M2. They took the MacBook Pro 13 with all of its weirdness already. The fact that that got upgraded to an M1 in the first
from years
place,
and years ago,
with the touch bar, with no notch, no MagSafe, and they went from an Intel to an M1 to an M2 now. And it's fanned, so that's good if you're a heavy user. But to me, the touch bar immediately makes it a no-go. Like, I have never owned a Mac with a touch bar. I thought that was the worst design idea they ever had. I'm one of those people. I'll own it. But yeah, it's I'm excited about the fact that the Air, you know, that they dropped the touch bar with the M1 Air. I mean, the Air never really had it, but that kind of went serious with the current Pros and stuff. And I'm glad that, you know, I'm not a big fan of the notch, but I'm glad that the webcam is better on the Air M2. But this doesn't have the better webcam. It has the old one. It's like, what were you thinking? What is, and it's $100 more. Like, I don't even think this computer is going to sell. You're talking about returns and refurbished here. Like, why does this computer exist?
This computer exists because, in my theory anyway, is that the MacBooks with the M2 Max and the M2 Pro are next year at the earliest. So if you want a MacBook Pro with an M2, this is it. And it's now or, 9 months from now. So I feel like it's a complete placeholder. I think I can only think that the people who are going to buy it, like if I was an average Joe MacBook buyer, kind of in the need for a new computer. Oh my God, wait for the Mac, wait for the ones with the new processor. But if you're a company and it's not your money and somebody needs a new MacBook, sure, get that one. They'll pass it on to somebody else in 9 months, some junior person in 9 months, and it'll be fine.
Right. Yeah. So, I don't know. Maybe it's for those people who really want a touch bar. That's my theory.
Maybe so, but that's it. Maybe that should be the review headline. Is like, look, if you really want a touch, the touch bar, this is probably your last chance.
They did update that chassis to the scissor keys, though, right?
I believe that they have completely gotten rid of the horrible
butterfly. I was gonna say, I hope so, because otherwise, OMG.
Yeah, it cost them so much.
Anyway, look, I'm excited about it. I'm probably going to order an Air M2, at least for my spouse, Theo, who has right now is on a last gen Intel, the final gen Intel Air, and struggling with the fan and the RAM and other things. Right. I'm on an M1 Air, so I'm okay for a little while. But anyway, I want to move on to some news, folks. We're going to rapid fire this stuff because it's not a lot. There's some news that I kind of forgot to mention a couple of weeks ago. The Oppo Reno 8 series came out. Oh, Oppo, what are you doing? Two Reno series a year at this point. Last year, we got the 6 and the 7. This year, we're going to get the 8 and the 9 in the fall, the 9. And the year before, we got the 4 and the 5. It's just like every 3 months or 4 months, they were coming out with a new phone. And the Reno is the mid-range for Oppo. It's always been a little overpriced, but I think they're finally coming back to form. When the Reno line came out first, they were really premium mid-range phones. And then they kind of slipped into plastic land. They went from aluminum and glass to full plastic chassis and plastic backs or glass backs on plastic chassis. And I mean, they still looked great and felt nice and had all the tech and the specs, but I felt like Oppo was being lazy. But with the Reno 7 series, they went reintroduced, at least on the higher end models, the aluminum and glass, and made it look slab-sided like an iPhone, which I don't know if you know this, Ed, since you're more of an Apple reporter, but there is a tendency, a trend currently, and Android, especially at the mid-range, to make phones with slab sides to look like an iPhone. So that, you know, the camera pod's different, but you know, at first glance, you're like, ooh, is that an iPhone? Oh, no, you bought an Oppo or whatever, right? So the Reno 7 series, I got the 7 Pro, which is a wonderful phone, reintroduced the aluminum glass. And now we're seeing that again on the 8. We're also seeing a camera pod that looks strangely like the Galaxy S series, at least the S22 and 22 Plus and 21 and 21 Plus before it, which is odd because I'm not sure that maybe they're trying to go for, oh, you have a Galaxy. Oh, no, you have an Oppo and you spent less money. I don't know. I mean, the Oppo does make some $1,000 phones too with the Find series. But look, all I want to say is I'll put a link in the show notes to a Pocket Now story. This is nice. These are great phones. They have really good specs, good features. They don't have OIS on the main camera, but they have the Merisilicon X ISP, the custom processing, image processing chip that Oppo has, which is really good. I tested it on their flagship. So I think it's interesting. Check out the specs, check out the design. It definitely stands out, and somehow I missed it. So Oppo Reno 8 exists. Any thoughts on that, Ed?
Well, I mean, my thought is coming up with a really innovative design is hard and expensive. You know, copying other people, that's much, much easier and way safer. I mean, and it's fine. It's not like everybody doesn't copy from everybody else.
No. I don't mind. I'm just glad that they're back to, you know, making kind of premium mid-rangers and not copying out to plastics on these phones that, even though they look cool, were for a while a little cheap feeling. Now they're back to looking cool, but also being nice feeling, and really you get what you pay for, in my opinion. And then the other big news, I guess, of the week for phones has been that the Nothing Phone 1 is finally going to be launching on July 12th. The official launch date is out there. As you know, Nothing is CarPay's new baby. CarPay was one of the co-founders of OnePlus, and he left to first launch a pair of earbuds last year, which have really cool design, co-designed by Teenage Engineering, a Swedish design firm that does some really cool musical instrument stuff. And the kind of trick there is that it's transparent almost. Like it's not just transparent like the iMac used to be. It's transparent to the point where you can't see glue or anything. It's glued together, but you can't see glue. You can, even the circuit boards are kind of like Apple circuit boards, black and on purpose black. Like, you know, they're manufactured to be aesthetically pleasing. It's a very cool design, and they sound great, and they have noise canceling, and they have wireless charging, and they cost $99. So that's pretty nice for earbuds. So what I think they're trying to do with the phone here is make a mid-range phone that's going to be, again, that kind of transparent industrial design with a really solid mid-range specs, very competitive price, just like the earbuds. Wireless charging has been confirmed on that phone too. So I'm excited about it. There's a lot of marketing BS and a lot of hyperbole because it's CarPay and Nothing is being very good at doing that kind of, like, you know, hyping stuff with their marketing message. But at the same time, if you kind of cut through all of that, I think there's some meat there. And I think I'm excited to see what's coming. Have you been kind of following CarPay's saga with Nothing?
I have. I remember we covered the Nothing headphones. I mean, it's not all AirPods over here.
Good.
And they are, I mean, they're definitely interesting. And I'd be curious to see what he can do with the phone. It's tough. I mean, you know, the US market is Apple or Samsung and then everybody else. But at the same time, you know, if he can sell, you know, 10 million phones or, you know, throughout the world, that's a good market. You don't have to be the biggest or even the second biggest phone maker in the world to make a good product and, you know, that people love. Before I ran out and buy it, I would look carefully to see what they say about Android updates.
Yeah, for sure. I think what's going to happen with this phone is it's going to be a good phone. It's going to mostly be popular in Europe and maybe in Asia. And they might partner with the US carrier. That would be interesting because they really need the US carrier to get going. And CarPay has relationships with T-Mobile. He's the one who essentially built the OnePlus T-Mobile relationship. So it could be that would work. But it's not about selling devices. This is about creating a brand and then offloading it to someone. It's about being acquired. This is the play, in my opinion. Crowd is a smart guy. You cannot survive as a new phone maker. It's a cutthroat business. You know, even OnePlus has been Oppo-fied now, and it's part of the Oppo culture, and it's kind of lost its OnePlus-ness for a lot of people. I'm personally not upset about that because I could see it coming, and I understand where they're coming from. But I think that this is like the next bit of Robin. You know, it's going to get acquired by someone because it's cool, and CalPay will move on and it makes some money and it's smart. And I could be wrong. Maybe he's really trying to redo a OnePlus again, but he doesn't have the backing of Oppo like he had before. So
you can never tell. I mean, that people said the same thing about Tesla. So you could be right, but
it doesn't have to be. He's not reinventing the wheel here. Tesla was really reinventing the wheel in a way. This is just another really good looking, really well spec, really good value, it's just another phone, right?
He's not really breaking into new ground. He's
in the same way as the earbuds are great, but there's lots of competition nowadays at $99, right? So the last thing on the news this week is we've known for a while that there's a Xiaomi 12 Ultra, their crazy photography flagship is coming. The Leica partnership has been official for a while now, but we've never actually seen the phone to kind of get a feel for like what's the crazy camera pod and the camera count going to be like. And now we have a render. So this is a leak, but, you know, take it with a grain of salt. But we're looking at something that looks a lot like the Honor Magic 4 Pro, which I showed you earlier, Ed. It's bonkers. It's got a lot of cameras. It's got a big, big meaty pod because you need that Z depth to get a lot of that stuff. Probably has a periscope lens amongst that roster there. I think I see it at the very top. Look, this is all we have. It's really nothing too exciting, but I know a lot of you are very excited because of this Leica partnership and because we have, you know, seen some really great thing last year from the 11 Ultra to potentially get your hands on this when you live in Europe or Asia. It's definitely not coming to the US, but I'll get one and I'll let you know what I think. It's going to be expensive. Like the really high-end flagships in Asia now are above €1,000 typically. So they're not pulling any punches. They're doing the best thing they can and pricing them accordingly. So, you know, if you have the money, yeah, why not?
It's an interesting market they're going for. We all know that the phone killed, you know, anything other than very high-end cameras. And there will always be a market for very high-end cameras. But kind of mid-range cameras got kind of thrown under the bus too, because most people are like, the best camera is the camera you have with you.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that companies are reaching out to that market.
For sure. I think it's going to be exciting. I'm looking forward to it. I have big news about my own career that I want to share with everyone on the podcast. And thankfully, it does not affect the podcast. Things are not going to change. So before I tell you, don't worry about the podcast. It's still continuing, but I will now be the managing editor at Pocket Now. Now, Pocket Now is mostly known as video, right? Jaime's video awesomeness. But there is a website and it's kind of a little derelict at this point. So my job, my role, my goal is to reinvent it. It might not stay named Pocket Now, who knows? But the bottom line is I have a website to play with. So we're going to actually expand the coverage a little bit. I came up with a tagline, tech that you carry and carries you. And the reason for that is because I want to start covering EVs and car tech in addition to mobile, of course, phones, and personal audio and wearables. Those are really the four focuses. And it's not going to be news. It's mostly going to be editorials, reviews, that kind of stuff. So stay tuned for what's coming there. In the meantime, the podcast continues. It's my own publication. I've struck a deal where I can continue doing it. And it'll be now published on Sundays instead of Saturdays because I want to be able to do it on the weekend instead of during my weekdays. Yeah, so that's exciting and big. Ed, we have to wrap up. I want you to tell folks where they can find you on the internet, where your social media handles live, and tell us where to find you, of course, Cult of Mac.
I'm a writer for Cult of Mac. I cover iPad, but I cover everything else too. I'm on Twitter, and my Twitter handle is Ed from Freelance, because I had to pick that a long time ago, back when I was a freelance writer. And I comment a lot on the Cult of Mac Facebook. So yeah, that's where you can find me. Thanks.
Yes. So folks, read Ed on Cult of Mac. And if you want to discuss this show, hit us up on Twitter. I'm at Tankgirl. That's TNKGRL on Twitter and Instagram. That's my handle pretty much everywhere. If you want to see pretty pictures of phones, pretty pictures taken with phones, pretty pictures of cars taken with phones. Instagram is where it's at. There is, of course, the website for the podcast, mobiletechpodcast.com, where you can subscribe. We're on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Spotify, everywhere good podcasts can be found. So please subscribe, tell your friends. If your app lets you rate or review the show, please consider doing that as well. It helps everyone. And there's two YouTube channels related to the podcast that are also continuing. They're youtube.com/mobiletechpodcast, naturally, and youtube.com/mobiletechmore. You know how YouTube works. Like, subscribe, tell your friends, click the little notification bell, comment in the comments. You can comment about the podcast as well. One is more the core stuff, phones, personal audio wearables, and the other one is more like the other stuff, like car tech, home tech, travel tech, etc. I also want to tell you about the Patreon, patreon.com/denkrl, patreon.com/tnkgrl. I mentioned it earlier in the show. If you want to see a video version of this podcast, you can do that on Patreon. There's a tier for that. There's also a tier to join my Discord server. Basically, if you can help, I'd appreciate it. If you don't like Patreon, I get it. There is a PayPal link in the show notes. You can buy me a coffee or something. Click through, make a donation. I'd love that. Finally, I want to thank my sponsor. MediaTek's dedication to innovation has made them a market leader in mobile technologies. MediaTek's Dimensity 1050 millimeter wave chipset will power the next generation of 5G smartphones with dual connectivity using millimeter wave and sub-6 gigahertz to deliver the speeds and capacity required to provide smartphone users with an incredible experience even in some of the most densely populated areas. So folks, I'd appreciate you checking out MediaTek's link in the show notes. And I want to thank MediaTek again for being our sponsor this week and Finbar for being my guest earlier in the podcast. And you, Ed, thank you so much for coming on board.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure and an honor.
Fantastic. We'll definitely have you on the show at some point in the future. And folks, exciting. We'll have another show next week. So I'll see you then. Cheers, everybody.
This has been the Mobile Tech Podcast with Tank Girl, proudly presented by worldpodcasts.com. You can visit us online at mobiletechpodcast.com.